You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
In this episode, Leonard Witt leads a discussion called How Web 2.0 and Disruptive Technologies Will Affect Us All at SoCon 07, an unconference which took place February 10th, 2007 at Kennesaw State University.
I want to start out with it. This is just going to be a little quick introduction sort of the history of open source software, because that's what sort of got a lot of this stuff going. And then we're going to move in to talk a little bit about open content and disruptive technologies, and also finally Web 2.0. And the best explanation for it and what we're going to be doing today actually happened last night. About 90 people showed up for dinner. And at our table, just at the one end of our table, because the idea behind this is everyone in this room knows more than any one of us who are standing up here. And so last night I'm at the table, and Janet, is she here somewhere? No, I don't see her. Oh, there she is over there. Janet is there, and Nick, is he around somewhere? Nick is over there, and Josh, are you around somewhere? Well, I was intimidated. You know, here I am, I'm going to be speaking, and obviously they knew a lot more than I knew. Now, I know what I know, but they know what they know. And the kind of interesting part about this is we're having this conversation. I'm learning a lot. They're learning from each other. And then if you expanded it to the whole table, everyone was learning. Then if you expanded it to the whole room, we had people talking about media. That's who our group was. We had people talking about online communities. We had people talking about podcasting, entrepreneurial stuff. And so this collective intelligence was in there. If it had been 20 years ago, that's where it would have stayed. You couldn't really tap into that. But Janet was telling me that she works for SAP, and they can very quickly do, through their program, they can quickly analyze everything that's going on in a company. And now she then is also, in her own mind, trying to figure out with other people of how that can actually happen with all of the stuff that you might be thinking about in different ways. So collectively, let's say I was thinking about biking. My bicycle. And she could tap into that. All I'd have to do is put some information out there. Other people could tap into that, and then they could associate it with other things. And that's basically what's happening. It's this interconnectivity. Not only the idea is there, but in Web 2.0, you find out how to connect everyone together. You find out how to have a conversation. And then, thanks to the computers, it actually comes up with new ways of thinking of things that we could never have thought of before. Okay? And the other part of it is that collective intelligence, if you figure out how to tap into that, you can make really great things happen. So with that, I'm going to start with Linus Torvalds. In early 1990s, on an online bulletin board, he was 21 years old, he put out a kernel of code. And he said, you know what, I need people to help me with this. And so people from all over the world, this collective intelligence, could tap into what he's doing. And here's the key part of it. If you were proprietary, like, we didn't know what everyone was thinking about at that table. And if you have a company, let's say you have 100 people at that company, let's say you have 200 people at that company, you're still going to miss all of the collective intelligence of everyone else in the whole world, so you're limited. Once you open it up to everyone, as Linus did, they started coming in, they jumped in, he released his program early and often. You had what you call, at that time, hackers were actually good people. They were coming in, helping develop the code. And the other key part of all of this is the users. The users then would come in and try it and say, this stinks, I can't get this done, or I want to get this done. The developers then would come back in and they would start fixing it. And it gets more and more robust, because the more you use the users in there, the smarter the program gets. Because if you just, let's say you're working with Microsoft, and you're just working with the developers, sometimes it's really hard to understand what the users want. If you open it up, and the users can jump in, and they're fixing it, the developers are fixing it, it's kind of this nice symbiotic relationship that everyone's working at the same time on. So the result of Linus Torvalds' work is Linux. And it's as robust now today as Microsoft is. Maybe more for a lot of people. A lot of people like it a lot better. All done with volunteer work. It's all free. If you want to go and use that code and rewrite that code, You can, as long as you allow the next group of people to come in and rewrite your code also. You can use it in any way you want. So when he did that, then there was Eric Raymond. He wrote this defining essay called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. And he said, and it's really important what he said here, he said, I used to believe the most important software needed to be built like cathedrals, carefully crafted by individual wizards or small bands of mages, working in splendid isolation, with no beta to be released before its time. But Linus Torvalds' style of development, release early and often, delegate everything you can, be open to the point of promiscuity, came as a surprise. No quiet, reverent cathedral building here. Rather, the Linux community seemed to resemble a great babbling bazaar of differing agendas and approaches, out of which a coherent and stable system could seemingly emerge only by a succession of miracles. The fact that this bizarre style seemed to work and work well came as a distinct shock. No one believed it could happen. And it's happened. And so then, after the open software movement, people started thinking, well, if they can do this open software with things like Mozilla Firefox, and there's a new blogging site called WordPress, which is relatively new. I mean, these are better than the stuff that was done by proprietary groups. So people started thinking, well, if you can do it with software, why not other areas? So for our purpose, we're going to turn to Jimmy Wales. He had this very big, admirable goal. He wanted to create and distribute a multiple lingual free encyclopedia of the highest quality to every single person on the planet, on Earth, in their own language. When he first tried to do it, he went out to the experts, and he asked experts to contribute to this for free. I think he said he had like about 4 entries over about 2 months. Nobody would do it. So then he had a sleepless night, and he said, I'm going to open up to the public and let everyone who wants to contribute to it can do it. And the result is Wikipedia, where now, in English alone, there's over 1 million entries, and they're all produced by people like you and me. You and me, or anyone else in the world, can jump in and do it. And again, how could you have this system where anyone can come in and edit it? So for example, if I wanted to do something with Kennesaw State, and this somebody did, somebody wrote the entry to Kennesaw State, anybody could start it. They put in just like, almost like Linus Torvalds did, they start with a stub of an idea or a kernel of an idea, and then people start to build on it. And then any one of you right now on your computer could come into that site and go to the edit page. Let's get to the edit page, next one. And right there, you hit the edit button, and you can rewrite everything that's on there. And so can the next person after that. And you would think, it can't work. I mean, if you ask anybody, that cannot work. You can't allow anybody to come in and fix and do something and make a robust good site. But in fact, it worked extremely well. So then we have to add to this open source part and open content. We move into sort of Web 2.0. And here is another defining essay. If you haven't read this and you're interested in Web 2.0, you have to read it. It's by Tim O'Reilly. And it's called, What is Web 2.0? And the interesting part about this, he just wrote this like 2 years ago. And he says, the central principle behind the success of giants born in Web 1.0 era who had survived to the 2.0 era appears to be this. They have embraced the power of the web to harness collective intelligence. The site, they get smarter with you. That's the other thing of this, and I'll talk about that in a second. And he said, in addition to getting smarter with you, every significant internet application to date in Web 2.0 has had a specialized database. So you think of something like Google. Why does Google work really well? Because every time you do a search, Google figures out this site is more important than the other one. Every time you link to it, Google figures it out. I don't know how all of that works, but it gets smarter and smarter with you. So does something like Amazon. People come into Amazon. They start building, they start putting in reviews. More people who use it, the more robust it gets, the smarter it gets. So if you can figure out how to do that, now when you're doing that, the thing you have to remember too, and a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to go and use this group of people to get my work done. Well, it doesn't work that way. Because Glenn Reynolds, he's a blogger at Independent, he said the way to get ahead in the 21st century is to figure out what people want to do, not what you want. Okay? And if you can tap into that, there's a whole lot of literature now about find a job that people want to get done and help them get that job done. It's not about going out Steve Rebell in public relations side. He's a blogger for public relations. He says, you don't want to go out and say, I'm going to build a community. That's the wrong attitude. You want to go out and say, I want to join a community. I want to work with that community and let it grow from there. So then we had, along comes Web 2.0, and in my area, I'm sort of interested in journalism, and then we move on to South Korea in 2002, and we have Omi News. Omi News, in South Korea, it was really hard. All the press was owned by a small group of people, basically. So Mr. Oh said, anybody can be a journalist. Well, 30,000 people now have written for Omi News. He has 17 people working for him, and a million people every day come in and read Omi News in Korea. It actually had a big effect on the 2002 presidential election in Korea. So, and now he has an international edition of it. And at about the same time, that's the international edition, and then at about the same time out in California, Craig Newmark, how many people know who Craig is? All right. So Craig Newmark, here I am with Craig Newmark, one of my favorite people. Craig Newmark started Craigslist. And he put up a site where his friends could trade information on events and things they wanted to sell. It started to grow like crazy. Citizens put up stuff for sale. Others came to buy stuff. It's mostly self-policed, and that's the important part about all this. Like, Craig, in the beginning, had like 3 people. I think he has like 17 people maybe working for them. But the last, there was an essay just about a week or so ago, 5 billion page views a month at Craigslist. If you're in the newspaper business, Craigslist is killing you. Okay? Because what's happened, he has, and this is where the disruptive technologies come in, he has produced something that he gives away for free that we use to charge for. And you can't compete against that. And so now people all over the world, there's a couple more slides to say, right here in Kennesaw, somebody's selling this beautiful piece of furniture. So anyhow, Penelope Green wrote about Craigslist in the New York Times, and she said it resembles a marketplace on ancient model, chaotic, unruly, and vividly human. Again, that sort of bizarre model. You have to sort of have trust. And as all of these things are built on trust, that the people who use them are going to be okay. You have to have some filters, because you have to, one of the first things is you want to make sure you keep the incompetence out, and you want to also keep out those people who are, you know, the vandals. It's mostly free for him. It sells classified ads. And then along, like I said, Kristen Claytonson then comes around and says about disruptive technologies. And the keys in disruptive technologies, they're cheaper, simpler, smaller, and most frequently easy to use. Disruptive technology. Ask the people in the landfill business. Ask the people at Kodak, who just laid off another 3,000 people on top of 27,000 people when the digital era came in. Disruptive technology. And what it means, they had these long sustained models, which a lot of us have, that worked perfectly, and then along comes this disruptive technology and disrupts their long-sustained model. And let's just think about here. Look around this university. I think about the university all the time. But if you look at the academic model, and you're in this university right now, you'd be foolish not to ask, is there a cheaper, simpler, smaller, and more convenient model in our community? And there might be. You might ask all of those of you in business, you might be asking that same question about yourself. I'm just going to rip through a couple other things here. This is, of course, you all know about YouTube. You know, you put your pictures up, your videos up there. People come and watch them. 100 people watch my little cycling trip that I took with my wife to Vienna. There's, you know, we also have things like Chicago Crime Map. The Chicago Crime Map, somebody took, these are where the mashups came. They took the Google Map. They took another program, and they mapped them together. This one guy did it. So every week, he updates this. Every crime that happened in Chicago, you can find out where it happened closest to your neighborhood. And not only that, the best part of it is you can map out your jogging route or your route you take to work, and he'll show you every crime that happens along that route. Okay? And this is happening, and now he's in Washington, D.C., but just think about this map in all of the stuff that you all do. Let's say you're a preservationist, you know, you're interested in preservation. Any kind of map. And this is what this whole mashup thing is. People take these two disparate ideas, they put them together, and they create something really amazing. Okay? And it is amazing when you look at this thing. It's street by street. He's got about 10 or 15 different ways you can break out various information about, you know, violent crimes, you know, nonviolent crimes, etc., etc. Okay. And then there's places like MIT. They're giving away their courseware. At MIT, you can go there now, and you wanted to, if I wanted to teach a course, I could use, steal, borrow, it's open, there you, that's the whole idea behind it. I could use one of their syllabus, and I could actually go in sometimes and use every one of their notes and teach a course just like I do. And they're making it available to anybody in the country. So you can use a piece of it, you can use all of it. And then the result of that, then somebody matches that up eventually, is going to match that up with a $100 computer. So MIT now has a $100 computer that they're going to distribute to everybody in the world. Okay, and every child in the world, they want to have a computer, which means that every child in the world will have access to all the world's knowledge. Now, last night, Janet was telling me that if you're under 25 and you're in a dark place, and I didn't know this because I'm just a little over 25, you can actually use your cell phone to help you read what's going on here, you know? So somebody has this little image, though, that they talked about, that there will be a hut in a couple years, and they have no electricity in that hut. That little candle on there, you can crank your own electricity. So in this little hut, in some little African village, at late at night, when there's absolutely no light at all, the only light in that room will be coming from this mountain. And this kid's kind of studying the whole world, you know, knowledge. It's amazing what's going to happen. And the nice part about it is every one of us here in part of it. We have the next thing, the Sunlight Foundation. This is Flickr. Our photos are going to go up on Flickr. It's built into the Creative Commons. Anybody can put photos up there, and you can say in the Creative Commons is the copyleft movement. Copyright movement used to say you had to get in touch with the person. Copyleft, you say, you can use my photo, but if it's commercial, I want a cut of it. You can use my photo, and you can alter it. You can use my photo in any way you want, or you can't use my photo. And the Creative Commons part of Flickr, today people are going to be putting up pictures from here. Anybody, anywhere, can cash in on those pictures and use them in any way they want, depending on the attribution. So most of them will say, well, if you're going to make money off it, I want a little piece of it, but not all of them. And then we have places like Facebook, you know, and I keep, every once in a while to my students, I say my face, and they find that very funny. And then the Sunlight Foundation, you can go to the Sunlight Foundation, people all over the country are going on this particular case, and they're reporting on which families are taking, if you have a congressman, everyone calls their congressman and says, is anybody in your family taking any money from the work you do? And if they don't answer, then that's a little bit of a problem for them. And if they answer yes or not, we have a record of it. And if they answer no, and somebody else then does a little investigation, they find out about it. So it's going to keep the sort of government under a little better watch on government. And then, let's see, where are we now? Next one, please. This is that Creative Commons that I was talking to you about. Anybody can go up and sign up for the license. And I just want to come back then to all of these things that I've been talking about in general here. What we have, again, is this open source software movement moves into open content movement, moves into Web 2.0, and then finally we have these disruptive technologies. And today, you know, just yesterday at the table, I started feeling all this stuff, kind of physically, actually all these things starting to come together physically. And so what we're going to try and figure out combined in here today is how can Georgia get ahead of the curve in all these things? What kind of mindset do we need? And are there any other examples or epiphanies? Are the people here, is anybody here from O'Reilly? Is Tony here? Did you? Oh, there they are. So I'm going to ask you all to sort of kick off today. Remember, don't say anything until a mic comes, because Amber and Rusty back there, why don't you raise your hand? Amber and Rusty are podcasting this whole thing. And so everything you say is going to be on the record, but what happened, they were trying to do this, they had a little blogging event, a blogathon down in Savannah, but people weren't using the mic. So they don't have a very good record of what's going on. And it'd be nice. I mean, you know, 100 years from now, somebody will turn back and want to find out what people were thinking about back in the dark ages, sitting in this little auditorium. Can you imagine? They're all sitting in an auditorium. Yes. Anyhow, 100 years from now, and we'll have a record of it. So make sure you get the mic. So who's got the mic? Okay, so what you want to do is go over to get them a mic. And Sherry, you should be finding somebody else to line up so we don't have to wait for this sort of intermit. So if anyone else wants to jump in the conversation, raise your hand. While they're talking, somebody else will get the mic. So I want to know, these are both graduates of the O'Reilly, and I don't know if you know Tim O'Reilly, he does a lot of publishing and he's really way out in front of this. And the people who work for him and who've left there are called graduates, is that correct? All right, so maybe the two of you can talk a little bit about what kind of lessons about Web 2.0 or anything else you want to ask.
Sure. Actually, I'm the lucky one. I'm the only graduate of the two of us. Sarah still works for O'Reilly, and she actually just gave a Web 2.0 talk 2 days ago, so she might be better at this than I am. But, I mean, the big thing, the big takeaway I get from Web 2.0 is that, you know, like 5 years ago, everyone was like trying to solve these really hard engineering problems, and they're throwing math at it and all these human resources, and they're coming up with big, complicated, you know, systems for tackling any problem. And what people are realizing in Web 2.0 is if it's hard, you can get your users to just solve it for you. And that's been the theme in all the Web 2.0 work that I've done. Sarah, do you have anything?
You actually did a beautiful job of describing it. I think that the big things about newer websites is that they're data-based facts. They're not for sure where. They have some features that make them dynamic. They change when people use them, and they get better when people use them. They're really living things, and we're part of that, whether implicitly or explicitly. Explicit is like dig and you vote on things. Implicit, you link to a site, and Google takes that, your behavior, as a vote and uses it to generate new information that's valuable for other people. So I think the interactivity is used in a lot of things, but I think that's a good word to describe sites that and that evolve as we use it.
And Tony has a Crowdvine, is that what it's called? I don't know if we can find that when we do a search.
Crowdvine.com.
Crowdvine.com.
Crowdvine.com. You'll find it.
And he's actually set up a little database where you can kind of meta tag to, let's see. And so, but anyhow, this site was really good because I could go to the site before and I could find out a little bit about Tony and what Tony was doing and what several other people are doing in here. And it's all linked together. This is new, right?
Yeah. So I'm working on a site that lets anyone create a social network for, like, you know, a social network the way that Friendster, MySpace, and LinkedIn are social networks. Create one for their organization, for their event, for their hobby. So, you know, if you want to connect with, you know, other dog enthusiasts, you know, dog owners in Atlanta, you could start a social network for dog owners in Atlanta. That's the kind of thing I'm going for. And so, you know, I'm just about to release it as beta. Obviously, it looks better in some browsers than others. And, but I honestly, why anyone is not using Firefox is beyond me, unless they're using Safari.
We have Firefox.
As far as like whether or not it works and it has any sort of value, is like, you know, Sarah and I are coming here from California, and we didn't think we would know anyone. And it turns out that there's one actually graduate of O'Reilly here that I found through the social network, but we wouldn't have known anyone without like the opportunity to meet people through it. So I found it really useful for this conference.
The opportunity to, here I am, to introduce Josh to everybody. He's going to say a few things, but we are very honored to have Josh come up here from Orlando and share not only his expertise and knowledge, but help us make sure we do this right. So I definitely want to thank Josh for being here.
It's an interesting intro. Yeah, that's the pissed off picture of me on the stage. One of the cool things that I see is, I mean, Leonard's touched on, a couple other people have touched on, is basically sort of the community aspect of all these tools. And there was a statement that, you know, we're all sort of working towards a greater good. And one of the coolest things I see from sort of a social manifesto standpoint of citizens media, social media, what all these things, is it's forcing individuals to act more responsibly. And that's just an amazing thing. You can't get away with shit anymore. because somebody's going to out you on it. And so it's really interesting to see some of the organizations I'm working with really cleaning up their behavior, people acting better, more civilized, because you just have to.
Don't make me talk. I'm the worst person to talk.
When you take the mic, why don't you tell us your name and your organization, and I actually might even find them.
My name's Cody Rosenblatt, and my organization is really just me, for the purposes of this event. But I was going to say, I know exactly what you're saying in terms of organizations and things that have real identities. Things that have real identities not being able to get away with shit. But what I find disturbing sometimes is the way that just people get away with shit because they're anonymous. You don't know whether they're a dog or any of that. And I just think that's a topic that would be interesting for people to bring out today is, the role of anonymity. When is anonymity good? When is it bad? My name's Cody Rosenblatt, so there's not a lot of anonymity in that on the web. Because there's pretty much one. Jeff Haney's a little more anonymous, and Tom Smith, whoever he is darn anonymous. Anyway, I just think it's something for us to consider as more and more people get out there. I mean, if you look at Dig or YouTube or some of the comments, I mean, you'll see that there's a flip side to this, people being more civil, which is people being ridiculously uncivil. And in a way that bothers me. That I don't think is helpful.
I had just a quick comment. I wasn't really going to say anything. Murray Grievous, I'm the IT and online director for Creative Lotion. But a comment just real quickly brought something to mind that someone said they were talking about, it works better in some browsers than others. And I just want to comment on what I find because, we're about trying to build community at Creative Lotion, but also trying to make a little money. And part of the problem I have with my staff sometimes and other people in the industry is what I call snobbery. I mean, 85% of the world is using Internet Explorer, whether you like it or not. And it's hard sometimes to break through that when I'm talking to people. And I know from our stats, that we do stats pretty extensively, is you would figure our demographic is going to trend more towards the type of people who would use Firefox and Mac than we do. But even for us, it's still 78% of people are using Internet Explorer on a PC. So, like I said, I wasn't going to say anything, but that's sort of one of my pet peeves and sort of a stammering and elitism I see sometimes around, these type of gatherings and social networking that, if you're not using a Mac, if you're using Firefox, then you're, oh my gosh, So that was it.
Yeah, my name is Jonas Luster, and let me address you first, please. I was applauding really loudly when somebody asked, I don't know why people don't use Firefox. About 30 years ago, 40 years ago, mostly across the world, women were not allowed to vote. And 80% of the world thought women not voting is a really, really good idea. And I think people stood up and applauded really loudly when somebody came up with the idea of more openness, bringing more people in, opening it up more widely. And I will applaud if a large corporation that thinks that DRM is a good idea to have in a browser, checking my browsing history, gets upset by a small company that gives me that source, lets me look at it. Well, they're making a lot of money, don't get me wrong. Firefox is making more money than Microsoft from their browser right now. The Mozilla Foundation gets a lot of money from Google. But they're open about it. And that's why I'm going to applaud. I'm not going to be open. I will never support IE. Not for the reason that IE shouldn't be supported, but for the reason that everybody can use Netscape. Not everybody can use IE. That's the main reason why I'm applauding loudly. That's not snobbery. That's me trying to be not snobbish, not to be restricted to one operating system, not to be restricted to large freaking ass computers that only process Microsoft Windows Vista right now, because you're not getting anything else anymore. But I wanted to talk about, wanted to address something else that you said, Jeff, and that's about the bazaar and the cathedral. And really interesting thing is that the guy who painted cathedrals, or the guy who painted built cathedrals, you know this one name about them, right? There is,
Richard van Aalst, the guy who built the cathedral in Amsterdam, one of the biggest cathedrals, is quoted everywhere. That guy didn't build the cathedral. That guy sat somewhere in a room, and he commanded 1.5 million people that built the cathedral. We don't know their names. And you move on to lauding the bazaar and how cool the bazaar is, and I'm completely on board with you there. The bazaar is millions of people again, and everybody has a voice. Then you move on, and you talk about people like the incredibly cool Jimmy Wales, who didn't write more than 5 pages on Wikipedia. You move on to talk about Steve Rubell, who said that communities are not being built, quoting one of my students, but you quote him. You move on to talk, to show pictures of really, really cool people standing all the way up there who haven't done anything for the movement other than verbalizing it. That's very, very cathedral. We're still really, really deeply in the cathedral. That's not a bazaar.
Yeah, actually, you're right. And I find that every day, you know, that I kind of find myself in my classroom, for example, I'm still standing up there and lecturing too much rather than tapping into their intelligence. And when I do it, it actually works better. I do less, you know. I feel guilty because they're doing a lot of the talking and we're interacting. And I think, well, I'm supposed to be getting paid for this. I'm supposed to be the one doing this. But it's really a mindset of sort of moving over. Now, there is a little bit of an argument about groupthink versus singular thought, you know. And I don't think we can sort of divorce those and have one better than the other. We got to figure out how to integrate them. Because some people do come up with amazing things to change things. But we're finding from all of this that it is a crowd kind of thing. Here's Jeff.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Jeff Haney. I'm one of the organizers and sponsors. I want to kind of, I guess I'll address Jonas first, since that's kind of the hot topic right now. I think you can't really dissect sort of capitalism from what we're doing here. Capitalism, a lot of people might say it's bad, but obviously we're all probably working for somebody right now, so it's probably a good thing as well. And it's also, you know, you could probably make the point about Google. I don't know how much Larry and Sergey probably write a lot of their core code these days. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of people that came along behind them and really made Google what it is today. So I think, but you know, joining in on the conversation I think is important. Is, you know, what, and I think sort of to address the Firefox is really what I wanted to address, is I think what's important is you know, Microsoft and what they're doing on the web and what they're doing with standards and what they're not doing with standards, I should probably say more. And why Firefox and why Mac and why that sort of snobbery matters, I think, is because it's sort of like a lot of trends that happen, a lot of the trends we're actually here talking about today, it started by groups of people like ourselves. We got together and said, enough. Enough is enough. Let's do something about it. Let's join together and let's raise our voice collectively and let's say a Firefox is a better browser. And let's do something about it. And eventually, you know, Microsoft's going to stand up and do something about it. They're either going to make a better product or maybe they won't. And maybe people will all be using Firefox. So that's what I'll say about that.
Since we're on devil's advocacy, hi, my name is Steve Ely. I've got a podcast called Skate Pod. We narrate science fiction short stories. And I actually came here as a bit of a cynic. I've not been a fan of the Web 2.0 label as a concept. I actually came here partly to see if I could have my mind changed about that. I am a fan of Wikipedia. I'm a fan of several applications that are out there that have gotten lumped under this big umbrella called Web 2.0. But I always feel that there's a bit of a danger when, yeah, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. In cases like this where something is new, the medium becomes about the medium more than anything else. And there's a lot of Web 2.0 talk out there of people who aren't actually making anything, or there's no specific product, or there's no specific message they're trying to get out. They just think it's really cool. And everyone wants to talk about Web 2.0 without necessarily attaching it to anything. And, that's why I'm very skeptical about labels that are not about specific applications, specific products. And to me, what I see is a lot of different things and a lot of different applications that everyone wants to bring under one umbrella. And I'm not completely sure that they can be. I see what you're saying about, you know, collective consciousness creating all of these applications and things. but they are so different from each other, and there's so much out there where people just kind of want to talk about social networking without actually having anything that the network is about.
Is that bad or good?
Well, I think it's bad if the conversation becomes too masturbatory, to use a strong term for it, then it all goes into navel gazing, and very often very, very bright people are then in danger of just congratulating themselves on being trendy without actually going forward and making anything from it.
Because I know Janet last night was saying if her program sort of worked, and Janet's back there, maybe we can... Jenny? Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, there we go. Well, there's my collection. Okay. So, but if you can take the mic over to Jenny just for a second. Huh? I was just going to ask you about if those conversations are going on and if they seem sort of individual and unique and really don't seem to have any purpose, like he's saying. They might really have purpose, right? Okay.
Hi, I'm Rashid Mohammed. I work as the web coordinator for the Vice President for Research at Georgia State University. I wanted to make a couple of comments regarding the whole browser thing and the Web 2.0 thing. Personally, you know, I started using the web like 12 years ago using Netscape on a Sun OS machine. I think Yahoo was the first website I ever visited, and it completely changed my life. Obviously, my profession right now is a result of that fateful www.yahoo.com way back. And, you know, I've been a huge Netscape advocate over the years. I've been a big anti-Microsoft advocate. I spent a lot of time, you know, during the early parts of the Mozilla movement to really advocate for that web browser, because I really saw the potential of the web as a mechanism to really bring people together. It's a beautiful thing, which is also why I think that this whole idea of social networking is some new phenomenon is interesting to me, because I felt like from the beginning that was the whole point of the web, was to bring people together. And now I'm hearing that this is all of a sudden some sort of, or maybe not all of a sudden, but this is somehow some core tenet of Web 2.0, but it was Web 0.0001. But back on the web browser thing, though, is that the thing that makes the web so great is the fact that the web, or HTML, the simplicity of getting your message out to other people, is something that defies the tool that you use to browse to a website. Whether you use an open source client or a proprietary client or whatever, the point is that you're communicating with other human beings. And it's, for me, even though I spent a lot of time in the trenches, I said a lot of bad things about Microsoft, I really feel like the bigger point here is the web, is that networking, that connectivity. It's not the actual browser. Yes, we want web standards. Yes, I almost died during the browser wars when I had to make two different websites for every web browser. But, you know, now things are better. They can get better for sure. But I just really feel like the beauty and the utility of the web really overrides any sort of technical, religious type affiliation that we may have. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ken Grisnak, and I'm communications and marketing with Five Seasons Brewing Company. We are both an organic restaurant, and thank you very much, and a world-class brewery. I'm responding to Stephen's comment. I am absolutely passionate about the issue of trying to connect people on the basis of level. Let me ask the group this. How many of you today are planning to eat something? We have all that in common. And I'm also struck, Tony and I spoke about this yesterday. I most recently came from San Francisco, and I took great food, real food, for granted for too long. I came back to Waffle House, Applebee's, Zaxby's, Arby's, you know, and there is a choice and there is a difference. And so I'm really struck by how we can connect people with on the basis of level. And I think that's what Web 2.0 does. And I'm also struck, sir, by your comment about Georgia. and trying to bring Georgia up to the curve or maybe even ahead of it. I encourage everyone to join together to drag Georgia kicking and screaming into the 21st century or die doing it. Thank you.
I just have one quick question about, you know, you mentioned Waffle House and all those other places. I think one of the things that worries me when we talk about these different communities and all is that, is this a snob sort of group? Is this a kind of the people who go to the boutique restaurants running this? Is it sort of leveled out somewhere that everyone can kind of get involved in? I think that's the promise of it, and that we have to be careful that we don't exclude the, you know, what everyone's doing on an everyday basis, whether we like it or not, you know, whether we like the Waffle House. And then I think we run into some problems sometimes because when you create these communities, it might not turn out like you wanted it to. Right.
So we're going to try to run around as much.
Sherry said she was nervous when I picked up the mic. I'm Rob Champa. You know what? I don't care about Firefox. I don't care about IE. I don't care about Ubuntu and everything else. I think we're asking the wrong question. There's a comment made earlier about, you know, masturbatory techniques. Since we're a PG-13 audience, I've heard a lot about shit today. I want to talk about Web 2.0 incontinence, all right? What we're dealing with, I went to a blog the other day, and I'm in the security and identity management world, and the guy was talking about the neutering of his cat, okay? And what I realized going out there now, and our challenge, is that there's so much crap out there, okay? And what we have to be talking about is how people communicate. Ultimately, it comes down to content, okay? And perhaps Web 2.0 Darwinism will kick in, because our challenge as a group is how do we get through all this crap, okay? I use blog lines. All right, just as a tool, and I'm sure there's going to be biases for it again. And the reality is I can't keep up. And so we have to think about techniques, ultimately, get the right content out there and helping us find it. Until it occurs, I think we're going to be in a quagmire. I'm not sure how you folks feel. Can you keep up with all your blogs and all your reading and how much garbage there is out there? So we got to be asking ourselves, let's get off of IE and Firefox. Let's talk about content.
A couple of broad things. First of all, when I speak to organizations sometimes, my first slide says no tools. And first, it means don't be an asshole. And second, is that we're not going to devolve into a discussion of tools. Because when you start talking about Firefox and IE, you immediately start polarizing the room, and the discussion sort of drifts away from what you really want to talk about. Now, not to take you on in the sense that you got off the elitist stand by saying, okay, I'm not about these discussions, but then you say, I'm reading this content and it's crap. It's not crap to other people. Recently, I did a session where I had this baby blog up, and I showed it to a group of publishers from some of the top newspapers. And one of the publishers goes, who reads crap like that? And the other publisher goes, that's my granddaughter. And suddenly, the whole room changes. You know, you're like, oh, well, it's not complete crap. It's kind of crap. You know, that's... So the thing is, like, you start looking at it, I mean, you know, stop talking about, okay, do you use this or do you use that? Are you on Google Type or on WordPress? You start talking about the actual use, what's going on. I have a nonprofit that is using MySpace to interact with teenage mothers, and they're saving lives every single day because they use the tools that are out there. They have no idea what runs it. They have no idea how it works. They don't even know how really to turn on their computer, but they can use these tools to get out there and do some amazing stuff.
My name is John Crow. I have a podcast called Paluma Coast to Coast. This is in regard to Leonard's comments about elitism. I think actually elitism is good. It's what drives communities. It's what makes people passionate. So you may have one group that is very pro Waffle House, and you may have another group that's very pro Arby's, and they may even have a rivalry. But that's what generates community and passion. If you have this homogenized, non-passionate community, what are they going to generate? What are they going to do?
Actually, I just want to mention one of the guy, Eric Von Hippel, talked about this a lot. And those of you who are in any kind of business, you want to look out for your lead users. And what they do now in a lot of corporations is rather than try and figure out in their own heads what people are going to use, they look out at their lead users. So if the newspapers had looked at bloggers 3 years ago, or 4 years ago and some of the other stuff that's going on, they would actually have a really good handle on what's going on. So a lot of you in your own industry want to use, look at, I guess you'd call them the elite group, but they're your lead users, and if you can tap into their energy and their knowledge early on, it can really direct you to have much more robust and better products.
My name is Michael Mealing with Master Space Systems, the day job, but just a quick survey. How many people were involved in the internet technology business in 93, 94? Okay. How many of you were involved in the business in 2000? Okay. I want to go back to your cynicism, because I'm getting a real bubble vibe, because I'm seeing a lot of some of these things that have the proverbial question mark at the second stage, which involves the revenue. So this, some of this stuff is important, and it's a tool. But be very careful that you do not confuse a tool with a business, and that a community with a customer. Because you may end up trying to build a business that ends up making a lot of people happy, but makes you poor and broken. There are a lot of... Sorry? No, but if you go in with your telling your if you go into it telling your wife that you're going to be rich and you end up with a happy community and no money, your wife does not like that. Yes. Or your husband, yes. I'm speaking from personal experience, so yeah. So yeah, if you're just now coming to this, go talk to the people that were in another hype curve, because this is very similar, and getting some of the same vibes off of it. So be careful, talk to people who've been through it, and make sure you do have real revenue in your company.
Hi, I'm David Reed with Atlanta IT Alliance for fun, and then Matrix Resources for, that's how I pay the bills. What I do at Matrix is sit down with enterprise architecture directors of development all the time. So from an enterprise architecture side, what I see is the problems that people, developers face is that the development cycle is getting shorter and shorter, where it was a year, then it moved to a quarter, then it's monthly, now it's weekly, but they need to have updates and changes. What I see happening with the, what I see happening with Web 2.0 from an enterprise architecture standpoint in companies and changing the way companies work is anytime you make a change in a piece of software, they go ask the users, and then it filters up through management, and we'll select these fields and these tabs, and this will flow from here to there. What Web 2.0 brings to the table is that if you can build something that's malleable and pliable, it'll mold itself around the business practices, and it'll move extremely fast. Your business, the technology can mold itself around. We've all been in companies where they say, here's all the required fields, and you put in 770-123-4567 for the phone number because it's a useful field, but you have to put it in to get it to work. So I think the where the money comes in, at least I see from an enterprise side, is not having all that time wasted in the development, in the requirements gathering, in the development process. You really let the users in the process, the business processes, mold, react more quickly to the marketplace, and that whole process just moves so much faster.
Sorry for not standing up, one of those laptop people. I'm Shelby Highsmith. I'm here basically from the Young Democrats of Atlanta. I used to run communications for them, and I wanted to rephrase the us versus them question for some of you to keep in mind throughout the day as you go about your discussions, not so much in terms of this browser or that browser, but my browser or no browser. I noticed from the Crowdvine site that a lot of you here are interested in business online and probably making money out of it. I'm here specifically pursuing a career that will make me no money. Political operatives make crap. But the us versus them question is that in terms of reaching out and, you know, creating community empowerment through Web 2.0. It's very nice to talk about community empowerment, but a 2005 Pew Internet and American Life Project report pointed out that 57% of African Americans go online compared with 70% of whites, and only 26% of Americans in the AARP crowd go online. So there's about a third of the population who is not participating in the Web 2.0 community building. And so for those of you here interested in terms of social change through social media, that's something that I think we're leaving out of a lot of our discussions, because, you know, we'll see in about 20 minutes Barack Obama is going to, you know, announce for president, and he's doing it online, and Hillary's got a video, but lots of people don't see these things, and they're not part of the conversation. So we need to think of World 2.0 while we're working on Web 2.0.
I actually want to address that just for a moment about the ripple effect. Just because there are people who are not online does not mean they're not getting the information, getting the information fast. One of the things I want to, a couple points I want to make from my experience. A lot of people who think that social networks, social media, Web 2.0 is just for the youth, the new generation, the MySpace generation. Some of the clients I've worked with in training, what I found out is people are online, they just, and in social networks and participating. They just don't know what it's called, so they think it's somebody else doing it. They're stumbling into it through their searches and through their trend. The other thing I'm noticing is just because, remember when there were just that one TV in every other house or every few houses, but they gathered around the stores and their neighbors and everybody else, and they shared information. So as it's happening online, it is happening in the world. It's my thought, and I have to feel that.
I'm Michael Sater with Sater Creative, and I haven't registered, so. I look at this from a different point of view. I come from the print media and the branding side of things, and this whole conversation of community, which becomes its own, excuse my French, pissing match, is truly about each group having its own subculture. So though we may not see or recognize or value what another community values, there is an inherent value. Though some people love Waffle House because they've never been exposed to something different, that may be all they know, and they only know what they know, and they don't know what they don't know. So by us talking to the point of it being a commodity or it being a value from an entrepreneurial standpoint, the truth is that each of these subcultures and communities are merely a reflection of what we did in the past. Web 2.0 is merely the way humans interacted 300 years ago online. So we would gather around, we would talk, we would share stories, and some of those have no value, and some of them have an extreme value. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how the whole thing sorts out over time.
My name is Imani Channel. You guys can all hear me. I started my own blog called myurbanreport.com, and I'm also a grad student. I'm working on a couple of citizen journalism projects. My background is primarily in broadcast news. I've worked in traditional media for the past 10 years, and now I'm kind of dabbling in the whole citizen journalism thing. And back to the whole topic of content, that's one of the challenges for me personally, because I am looking for quality content on the internet. My project is sort of focusing on urban-related content, and, you know, when you watch the news, of course, a lot of the stories focus on, you know, crime and violence and that sort of thing, and I think that we would all agree that there's a lot of more positive things bringing our communities, and now people are able to share those stories via YouTube, Live TV, some of those other websites. I'm rather a novice to all of this. I just got into this like 3 months ago, but I'm learning a lot, and I'm glad to be here with all of you. So the question is, how can we, I think, inform the public, for those who are print journalists and for those who have TV background like myself, how can we inform people who are novices, who are trying to experiment and learn, and they want to get their message out, because of course anyone who puts up a video on YouTube, they think it's great for themselves, but a guy like me who worked in the news for 10 years, I'm looking at it like, wow, you need a tripod, you need to use a microphone, the video is way shaky. So, you know, I just think that it's an educational process that, you know, and of course there's a theory that the positive things will sort of rise to the top of the quality, things will rise to the top of the internet also, and that people will find good content. But there definitely needs to be some sort of way, and maybe this is what will come out of discussions like this, how can we aggregate it? How can we inform the public? How can we get people to start producing quality journalism? Because we can all be journalists. I mean, people are capturing, you know, cell phones and video phones and all sorts of things and sharing it. I mean, the news doesn't care how you get the picture. I mean, you can capture it on your cell phone, you can have your camera phone, whatever. They just want the picture. So we all have that power. The question is now, how can we sort of get everybody to participate? And I think his issue of how many people use the internet is also an issue in that disparity, but I guess that's for another discussion. But thank you again, and sorry for rambling so long.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Carroll, and I don't represent anybody but myself. First off, I've got to say, as an Irishman who's been living in the South for 20 years, I think that Waffle House is getting a very bad rap this morning. Now, that said, I have actually three things that occurred to me as I've been watching what's been going on here this morning. First off, we saw the mashup showing crime in Chicago. And the first thing that struck me about that demonstration was it's only as good as the data that it's based on. And I say that because Atlanta crime rates a couple of years back took a precipitous drop. And it turned out that they took a precipitous drop basically because the chief of police had said, start closing cases, however you do it. So they basically, excuse me, I'm nervous. They started sweeping all this stuff under the rug. And so you could do a mashup of Atlanta crime, which would show Atlanta to be, you know, the next heaven on earth, and you could go out your door and get mugged anyway. That's one thing. Second thing is, I heard your man from the Democratic Party talking about, you know, getting everybody online and making it like a fully... I think the tendency is to want to use the web to move our politics to pure democracy. And what struck me that when I thought about that was there's a series of books by Frank Herbert, a science fiction writer, and he posits the creation of a bureau of sabotage because government gets so efficient that laws get passed so quickly with so little reflection, the government has to actually create a bureau of sabotage to stop all these laws going into effect to save people from their democratic impulses. I thought that was good. The third thing, so as a JavaScript developer, I'm with your man over here. I mean, I've done a lot of JavaScript cross-browser issues have made me want to slit my wrists on occasion. And I hate to devolve back into a tool talk, but I've recently started playing with a thing called Flex, and I have a sense that that might be the solution to a lot of this cross-browser stuff. Anyway, just throwing out my thoughts this morning. Thanks.
Good morning. This is my name is James Harris. I'm CEO of ListenShare. We participate in organizations as well as we're sponsored this morning. But it's really interesting to me to see the people here that are really focused on sort of screen experience. Just a quick survey. How many people of you are here because of the billboard that was on 285 during the conference? Or the radio ad that ran on? Right, so there wasn't. Right? So the reality is... Exactly, right? The reality is with a few emails and a wiki and a website that came about maybe a month ago, we're all here. This is really amazing. I mean, I remember sitting in meetings about this, and we thought if we got 50 people, that'd be a great deal. We got some pizza, hang out, have a good time. And then showing up at dinner last night, I was blown away. I kept going to Lynn's table going, this is amazing. This is great. This is great. So the reality is I think sometimes we focus too much on screen experience. Think about moving the world. Think about moving people. Think about using Web 2.0 to change what's going on in the pool. Think about what's going on with pregnant teens that need help and direction. I mean, that's where there's an opportunity. If there's any way for Georgia to participate in this, the state that brought Martin Luther King to the world and helped change how we think about it, how we deal with one another, that may be something that Georgia could actually be involved in. So think of beyond the screen.
I want to mention just a little bit about the social capital kind of thing that comes with this. And James is right. I mean, I don't know how all the people found out about it. I don't have a clue because we did a couple, it showed up on blogs and then people started calling. But there's probably now across the country, I have met 200 people across the country who I know really, really well. And about half of them I've never really met face to face yet. But at some point, I run into them. In these kind of situations, and I talk to them, and I get to know them, and we exchange ideas, and we all get smarter. And to me, that is sort of the luxury of this kind of community building, social capital building. I'm getting smarter every day through this thing. At least I feel I am. Maybe you don't think so, but I think I am. And I think everyone else is. And that's one of the things that I think we really have to kind of concentrate on, this idea of community building. And I notice that there's a lot of people who are interested in that. A lot of people did go over to the entrepreneurial tables last night, and a lot of people signed up for it. But on the other hand, a lot of people were, you know, crowded around that community building table. So I want to, are some of those community building people want to talk a little bit about why
they're going into that, what's on their mind when it comes to community building, or you can talk about why you got into the entrepreneurial part. There's somebody over there who we haven't talked to.
Hi, my name is Josh Watts. I'm with Blue Violin, which is awesome, by the way, because it all works right. I found out about it because I've stumbled upon Jeff's blog or something like that about a month ago. I said, well, that's pretty cool. The whole entrepreneurial thing is really about community building as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, there's a lot of collective hand-wringing that Atlanta's not a friendly place for startups. I personally think that's a load of crap. Because we have all the resources here, we just aren't connected together. It's, you know, the best way to start a business is to talk to somebody else starting a business and figure out what they're going through, and you can help each other out, bounce ideas off each other, stuff like that. But, you know, community building and the entrepreneurship, I think, it really goes hand in hand, because even if you're trying to build a community for online pine cones or whatever, you're trying to start something, and the process you go through is exactly the process that somebody else in the business is going through as well. I mean, I don't really think there's a difference anymore. An entrepreneur may want to make money, or he may just want to do something to say that he did it, kind of like what Linus did with Linux. I mean, he started this whole thing and has really, you know, not become very wealthy on it, but he can walk into any development shop around the world and get a job, or he'll have people flocking to him and want to talk to him for hours. You know, that's the kind of stuff that money can buy. But anyways, you know, the whole thing about building a community and stuff like that is just to help each other, and I think that everybody has senior points of expertise. And, you know, just getting it out there, let people know about it.
So I'd sort of like to talk a little bit about the community aspect, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of the things that are happening on the web are really the outcome of very primitive behaviors that we already have offline. So, I mean, I think a lot of people question MySpace's value, and lots of people, like we said earlier, have found ways of making MySpace actually change lives. And so, one of the great things about what's going on the web is in the early 1.0 web, which me and a lot of people probably in this room have participated in, it was really a one-way kind of dimension. It was more thought of as sort of a marketing vehicle, a push content to people, sort of a one-way kind of mechanism. And the web 2.0 is really about participation. It's more about two-way web. It's more about collaboration. And it's more of finding ways that people can kind of get together and actually make change. The change might not always be social. I mean, it could be technical. It could be organizational. It could be business related, like we talked a lot about last night. How do you get together? I mean, this meeting in itself was, like James said, was just, you know, a few of us sending out emails, a number of us blogging about it, and largely just networking. Word of mouth is the best form of advertising still available. And so I think that's sort of the outgrowth of social networking and the outgrowth of a lot of things like Wikipedia. It's like, how do we work together, you know, and how do we kind of push information, not just to the web, but how do we interact with it? How do we interact with that content? And how do we participate in that content? And I think that's very exciting, because we're all here but doing that today. We're having an unconference. Typically at a conference, somebody would stand up here, the so-called expert, and would kind of push information to the audience. The audience might get a chance to raise their hand, but largely not. Or they might be able to crowd the speaker at the end of the conference with a bunch of questions and take their business card. But what we're doing today is we're talking about what we want to talk about. You know, we're participating in the conversation and collaborating together. And it's going to take all sorts of turns. We're going to talk about Firefox versus IE, which ultimately doesn't probably matter. We're going to talk about how bad some content is, but at the same time, other content, how great it is. And I think that's sort of the beauty of what we're doing here, is we're sort of bringing a lot of these sort of primitive behaviors online and connecting with larger groups of people that maybe we wouldn't have a chance to connect with otherwise. So I think it's very exciting. I'm very glad to be here and be part of it.
As for how everybody heard about this, I just assumed that Cheryl emailed everybody. That's how I heard about it. But I've I wanted to address the community building and what you just said about word of mouth. I think that raises, at least to me, what may be one of the most critical questions about this new pattern of community formation and community building, which is the problem isn't necessarily building the community. The problem is marketing the community, getting it out there, making sure that people who want to be part of that community have actually heard of it. And yeah, I cannot think of a better answer than word of mouth. Most of the podcasts I listen to are because somebody told me about them, the blogs I read, the web comics, it's all because someone told me about it. But that means that there's also so much stuff out there that I would enjoy or that I would get something out of that I've just not heard about because I don't talk to the right people. And if there's an efficient answer to that, a way to make word of mouth more efficient, then I think that's really where that could be the holy grail of a lot of this stuff, because, I mean, there are answers out there. You know, Dig, I think, was intended to make word of mouth more efficient, but then you get buried in so much content on Dig that nobody has time to read it. You know, there's... How do you get to somebody just the communities that they want to be a part of that their friends don't already know about?
So I'd like to respond quite quickly. I have no idea what the answer is to that. I think that's the next Google, personally. I mean, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, obviously, in the room that are interested in entrepreneurship. I mean, I believe the largest... What we're seeing right now is this massive information flow online and sort of this ability for lots of people to interact with change and lots of people to add content, sort of the long tail of content on the web. And certainly search is one way of doing that. But I think relevancy and trust-based information is really the big thing that's going to make this difficult if we don't figure out how to solve that. Because you're right. I mean, I have hundreds and hundreds of RSS feeds to blog. I can't keep up with them anymore. Tagging's great. But there's just too much information and too much information that's not relevant to me. It may be relevant to the next person, but it's not relevant to me. And so I think that's the big opportunity. So if somebody start a business and we can.
I think one thing that's been kind of hitting me as I'm listening and absorbing is we're Web 1.0, for lack of a better terminology. And if I start rambling on, I just had a baby and I've had no sleep. Well, I haven't had a baby. My wife has. Hit me in the back of the head, turn off the mic, whatever.
That would have been a lot more impressive, but that's cool. Congratulations.
Exactly. I've gained enough weight, you might think I've actually, but that's a whole different thing. Is that I think Web 2.0 really is starting to integrate and be technology friendly for people who aren't, so that people that really have a lot of energy and passion about a topic can contribute now to the web. Which I think it's less about the information, but I think Web 1.0 was about information. I think Web 2.0 kind of brings the energy component of collaboration of communities. It's not, you know, I was driving in listening to a podcast where they're talking about the team is dead and it's now the collaborative that kind of, it's the community that really is more effective than a team. And that's kind of, I think, the reason that is so effective is because the person at the top doesn't always have all the energy. There may be somebody at the bottom that's got more passion and energy and information at any given time, and it's that flat structure that allows the energy to kind of swap out between different team players and really takes the effectiveness to another level for if you're getting together and talking about bugs, or you're getting together and talking about business effort.
Another part of that is Linus Torvalds said. He has this thing that he said that really stuck in my mind. He said, it seems to be unfair that if you put in 1 hour of work and you get 10 hours of return. And if we can kind of, I keep trying to think, now what kind of projects can I do that everyone puts in 1 hour and you get 10 hours out of it? Then it's really worth your time to work on. And I've been puzzling over that a lot, and I was walking around the campus one day, and I kind of sat down on a bench trying to think about what kind of project can I have. And then I kind of looked around me at Kennesaw here, and I realized, you know, there's 20,000 people involved in Kennesaw. And I'm one little, tiny, little piece of the Kennesaw whole thing. I contribute to it, but my little contribution makes possible this whole 20,000, everything we're doing right now. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to get to on the internet, how each one of us can be one little piece of this bigger, gigantic thing that can happen with us, but it can't happen without us at the same time. So, you know what I mean?
So. Yeah, well, actually, that resonates with a lot of what I've been thinking just from the last couple of comments, and Jeff said, you know, whatever kind of solves this information overload, maybe the next Google. And I'm not sure that will necessarily be the case, but I think a big component of what might solve it is probably in this room. It's probably people. Someone else said this before me, but I like the quote. I wish I could Google it right now to find it, but someone paraphrased Sterling Green to say, Web 2.0, it's people. And it is. I think that's what's most interesting to me. There's also a post. If you search for Joho, J-O-H-O, and Cody, C-O-T-Y, and click the first post, there's a post, I think it's, My Addiction, that David Weinberg really put together for my feelings about this, and this is my addiction described. You know, I want to know what's happening and what people are thinking and what's going on, and I think that's part of the power of what's going on in Web.0, because people are interacting through all these sites, whether it's big, which I think in many ways highly dysfunctional, or delicious, or Twitter, or whatever. People are trying to figure out how we can organize and have a group think that's constructive. And so I'm kind of a sci-fi aficionado as well, so I often think in terms of sci-fi stories. And there's a lot of sci-fi stories that have themes of kind of map group minds that come together. So I often think, you know, I think we're all trying to angle toward a future where we can all, you know, contribute to something that's greater than humanity has been able to do in the past, some level of organization and thought that can do greater things. And what I think is a challenge for that is something that I think this room, again, illustrates a way that we may surmount that challenge, but also some comments point out ways that we're at risk. In this room, we're all drawn together by, you know, relatively geeky things, Firefox and Web.0 and stuff like that, but we all probably have a lot of divergent interests. Some of us are okay with Waffle House. Some of us probably even really like Waffle House. Whatever reasons, I mean, and I'm a food snob, but I also grew up in the South, so it has some resonance. But I worry, on one hand, that people get too isolated into their little community of, you know, we hate Waffle House, and Waffle House, you know, produces nothing of real value, or we don't care about other people's babies. But which actually is really important. I think you should care about other people's babies. But I think we ought to look for the ways that, sure, we all have divergent interests, but there are, for almost every person in the world, there's something that connects us together, whether, you know, Haney and I, for example, diverge on a number of political points. But there's a lot that brings us together, too, and I think, you know, circling all the way back, I think the thing that will really make things work is bringing the world through that together, and for us to use the technology to make ourselves better people and make this a better world and find better connections.
Great. No better way to end than that. Make this a better world. So thank you very much. If you see Lauren out there, Lauren Booth, she's running around. She's got a black shirt. You might have already bumped into her. Say thank you, because she's really put in a lot of work on making this, the logistics work. She's really helped out a lot. And the chair of the department that made that possible is Birgit Wasmus, and she's over here. And I got to thank everyone at Kennesaw, who's really done a lot for us.
Interested in podcasting? Want to mingle with other podcasters or learn how to get started yourself? Then mark your calendar for PodCamp Atlanta, happening March 16th through 18th at Emory University. For more information and to add yourself to the registration list, visit podcampatlanta.com. And by the way, it's free.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of UnConcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.